Just a moment. Just a moment.
Welcome to the Future Law Podcast, exploring where the law has been.
Hey Siri, take a selfie.
And where it's going.
Oh, good afternoon.
From the brilliant.
My name is Sophia, and I am the latest and greatest robot.
To the scary.
Just what do you think you're doing, Dave?
And everything in between. Please welcome your very real and very human host, Mike Madison.
Welcome to the Future Law Podcast. This is your host, Professor Michael Madison of the University of Pittsburgh in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The future of law is being written, practiced, and experienced by people, but not only by people in a one lawyer at a time or one client at a time sense. The legal world is being built and rebuilt in institutions, organizations, and communities. And from time to time, the Future Law Podcast will take a deep dive into organizational cultures and social practices. This episode is part of one of those dives, a multi-part look at a major global law firm that has been recognized repeatedly for its global leadership and innovation across both North American and global markets. This is Orrick, Herrington, and Sutcliffe, usually known by the single name Orrick, after one of the firm's founding partners. Like the Orrick name, the Orrick firm has deep roots in California. Orrick traces its origins to a practice that opened in San Francisco in 1863, which makes it one of the oldest companies on the West Coast of the U.S. For many decades, Orrick was a rock-solid, highly regarded law firm located on San Francisco's Montgomery Street, sort of the Wall Street of mid-20th century California. Beginning in the late 1980s, as East Coast U.S. firms started to open offices in San Francisco, and as San Francisco firms started to look opportunistically at Silicon Valley to the south, Orrick started casting itself in a new and different light. The San Francisco legal community sat up and took notice when Orrick moved its San Francisco office to new innovative space, and noticed again when Orrick expanded its geographic footprint eastward to New York and then beyond. Today, Orrick is a genuinely global firm with more than 25 offices around the world, including offices in New York, Washington, D.C., Silicon Valley, and an unusual office in an unlikely location, Wheeling, West Virginia, in the heart of America's Appalachian Mountains, known today as Orrick's Global Operations and Innovation Center. Orrick doesn't represent all of big law, but it's a big name, big law player. What does all of this add up to? What do Orrick's efforts tell us about the future of law? In this episode, we dive into the world of ALSPs, alternative legal service providers, which form a now robust sector of the legal industry. How are private law firms and ALSPs coexisting in the market for legal services? When and where are they competing? How is evolution in the industry affecting demand for lawyers? How is it helping clients? The conversation focuses on Orrick's experience, and it features three guests: Daryl Shetterly, director of Orrick Analytics, the firm's in-house team of lawyers, statisticians, and other professionals that focuses on data modeling and other technology-assisted strategies; Liam Brown, founder, chair, and CEO of the law company Elevate Services, a leading legal services provider; and Basha Rubin, co-founder and CEO of Priori Legal, a global marketplace for helping in-house legal teams find the right outside counsel. Daryl Shetterly of the Orrick Law Firm, Liam Brown of Elevate Services, and Basha Rubin of Priori Legal, welcome to the Future Law Podcast.
It's good to be here, Mike.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Daryl, let's start with you. The theme of this podcast is really the relationships between big law firms and legal service providers. And I wondered if you could walk us through a preliminary overview of the state of that landscape from the perspective of Orrick.
So I'm glad you put it that way. I think asking it from the perspective of Orrick might be different from big law generally. So I can speak best for Orrick. I've been in this role for almost a decade. Here at Orrick, thinking about how we deliver legal services differently. And, you and I first met at a hackathon that we did at our Global Operations and Innovation Center in Wheeling, West Virginia, here where I'm based. And that's an example of the kind of exercises we've been doing for a decade of understanding, not just from our employees, as in that case, but from our clients. What is it that you want from your law firm? And understanding what they're trying to accomplish, what's important to them, and building then the teams that respond to those needs. So, for example, I lead Oric Analytics, a group here at Oric of more than 100 people, technologists, statisticians, project managers, folks who are attorneys with lots of different backgrounds and specializations, and we integrate into the matter. And our goal is to change the way we deliver legal services in the same way an ALSP might often be used to augment the more traditional lawyer team. And so here at Oric, we are pretty far down that road of building the teams, the processes, and delivering services differently. I think when you step back and look more broadly at big law, you'll find that a lot of folks are more new to having that conversation and are sort of at the beginning phases or closer to the beginning phases of asking the question, how do we bring different types of skill sets into that core team? And that's a big question that clients are now pushing with the emergence of groups like Clock and others who are trying to push this idea of legal operations and bring law kicking and screaming into the modern era.
Liam and Basha, let's bring you into the conversation and get each of you to give your perspective from where you are in the legal industry. You're partnering with law firms, you have law firms as clients, and in certain respects, sometimes law firms are rivals or competitors in certain aspects of what ALSPs are doing today. So how do you organize strategically and operationally the kinds of interventions, the kind of services that you're offering in your respective firms? Basha, let's start with you.
Absolutely. So it might make sense with just a couple of words of context about what my company does, and then figure out how it sits within the broader legal ecosystem, particularly vis-a-vis law firms of a range of different sizes. I launched Priori with a classmate of mine from Yale Law School in 2013, and we're a global legal marketplace for in-house teams to find, hire, and manage attorneys. And so that is everything from solo practitioners, who you might expect to be on a marketplace like ours, up to attorneys at AmLaw 100 firms, and now including within the remit of our platform, ALSPs themselves. So we see ourselves fundamentally as a technology company that is agnostic to the kind of service provider within a certain range of quality who participates. And so from that perspective, we want to welcome and embrace with open arms the full spectrum and provide the tools for clients to make comparisons and decisions about the right kind of service provider for a particular set of problems. And sometimes that is a big law firm, and sometimes that is a solo practitioner, and sometimes it is an outsourced ALSP solution that's augmented by technology or pure play technology platform. But we are all about creating the technology tools, the data, and the transparency in order to make those sorts of determinations.
Liam, from the standpoint of Elevate Services, you've been in this market and in related markets for quite some time. So I'm curious about how you've seen the relationship between law firms and ALSPs and their predecessors evolve, and what are the key sort of decision moments? What are the key variables that are driving the evolution of this market today?
So thanks, Mike. I think that the evolution is unevenly distributed. I think, Dow, you've made that point that different firms have different levels of investment, different levels of appetite, different skill sets, structures, and strategies. And so I don't think that there is one business model that's going to win out in the future. I listening to Daryl talk about bringing what I, you know, how we think at Elevate about this sort of interdisciplinary, expert-led technology and data-powered team, you know, Daryl talked about bringing them to the matter and delivering differently. What we spend most of our time doing is actually working inside the run the company, running inside the law department or the firm in the run the company, running a different race, rather than to the episodic moment in time of help me with this matter. So I bet you that if you actually lifted up your team, Daryl, and you lifted up Elevate's team, I bet you'd find many similarities. You know, we have our own, we have our ABS law firms, and that's how we use Basha. That's the structure that we use to be able to deliver those points of expert advice that are sometimes required in building delivering a service or building a solution. You know, those are our law firm capabilities. I guess is the best way to sort of simple way of describing them. I mean, there's some regulatory navigation that we have to do, but you know, we're not a law firm that is providing bet the company episodic advice. We are a law company that is providing this sort of ongoing run the company support, where you sort of integrate the same set of capabilities, all the capabilities that Bash is talking about bringing, that Daryl's talking about bringing. So I think that we're fortunate that the three of us are in some ways out there experimenting, rolling our sleeves up, working on really interesting problems, where we have probably got a lot of bruises and skinned our knee in many similar ways, but we are and we've got many similar capabilities. But I think the animating purpose of the customers we serve and the business problems we're solving are actually quite quite different.
And I hear folks talk about a firm like Auric competing with a firm like Elevate. I think that's the wrong way to think about it. We're really collaborators, aren't we? We're more collaborating almost as one giant service provider. And I think about that, we at Auric won a Financial Times Innovation Award for collaborating with an alternative legal service provider on a matter. And we don't think of ourselves as the law firm and they're the provider. We think of ourselves more as one unified law firm. And that's where we see law going. Law is going toward what does the right team look like for this matter? And using and pitting the different players against each other is like saying who's more important, the partner or the statistician? And the answer is yes.
Let me disrupt this harmonious story just a little bit to probe behind the scenes. From where I sit as a professor teaching a next generation of lawyers and trying to help them enter the profession and navigate career choices and job choices and trying to figure out where opportunities lie and where barriers exist. The feeling on my end is that, speaking of the law firm market as a whole, not speaking specifically about Auric, but speaking about law firms as a whole, that's a space that is, relatively speaking, tradition-bound, status quo-oriented, not interested in novelty and innovation, not necessarily creating opportunities for new lawyers to serve and impact society and support clients and so forth. Whereas the ALSP market, small enterprises, large enterprises, diverse enterprises, that's the space where there's a lot of opportunity, where flexible teams are being created, different kinds of talents are being drawn on. And I see Basha smiling as I'm going through this question. We're not broadcasting the video on the podcast, but we're all able to see one another while we're recording. And so I'm hoping as I spin out this little hypothetical that I'm prompting one or all of you to react and engage and maybe tell me that I'm wrong. So please tell me how I'm wrong.
I'll take the bait.
Okay.
I think that Obviously, you've told a story that we've heard before. For the past, at least, you know, I started law school in 2007. And at least since I started law school, and I suspect for long before that, we've been hearing that the big law firm is about to be disrupted. The billable hour will die. This model is not sustainable, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the change is pretty minimal. That said, I will, in what I've seen over the past 5 years, definitely, and the past 18 months in particular, the kinds of tailwinds that have been exacerbated by the pandemic will mean that a significant percentage of the law firm market needs to innovate, and they need to innovate soon lest they face very significant pressure. And they know it. I don't think there are some people, there are some ostriches out there, surely. But from what I see, law firms are actually really excited to innovate and really interested in creating partnerships across the ecosystem and understand that the future of law is not going to be a partner waxing poetic for hours and billing every second of that time. Instead, I think that law firms are thinking very seriously about how to build out teams that include the statistician and the technologist, so they're not disrupted by external providers. And they're thinking about with immense pressure from clients on different kinds of fee structures and different kinds of technology platforms that create efficiency at every stage in the process of engaging legal work and performing legal work. Ultimately, my prediction is that we see a lot of innovation coming out of the second 200 of the AmLaw 200, who are under particular pressure right now. And also, you know, some firms won't survive, but that's always the case. With that in mind, I think that an innovative lawyer who wants to be part of a future law firm doesn't need to go to an alternative service provider or new law company to find that. Liam, I don't know.
Liam, yeah, interested in your reaction to Basha's summary there.
So I've been building legal technology and legal services companies now for 25 years. And I have come to the conclusion that there is a lot of energy. It's fantastic energy around innovation in many firms, serving what the core of the law firm actually serves. And that is responding to what they call clients, their clients' episodic needs for help me with this, help provide me advice to help me navigate this significant event. At the end of the day, that innovation is around the client experience and a little bit around efficiency and cost. I know there's a lot of talk at what I call the ALSPs. That, you know, you'll laugh, Daryl. I actually call your business the ALSP because it's the alternative to the law firm, traditional law firm service model. Whereas I call companies like Basha and Elevate law companies. We're not firms. We're companies that operate in the legal space. And we're actually addressing a different problem. We're addressing these. The law in the core of the business that is growing, the demand for that law in the core is growing. Regulatory complexity, globalization, data, etc., is causing that growth. So I see the businesses like Basha's and mine as really helping the world avoid running out of people to be lawyers, because if you sort of continue the growth of demand in law, at some point everyone has to become a lawyer to be able to actually serve the needs that companies have, and I think that's kind of when the universe freezes. So I'm pretty clear that there is this. You know, I have an 18-year-old thinking about career, and you know, and of course, when the topic of law school even comes across the dinner table, you know, I basically say, look, you've got two paths. One path is there's this law firm path, which is there's a contribution to society. There's a advice to clients. It's a phenomenal profession. It's well rewarded. It's well trodden. You know, it's like becoming a management consultant or becoming an accountant or becoming a doctor. It is a fantastic career. But there is this whole other market, and I think medicine is a good example, but that just like many other industries, there are these whole new markets where young law students actually have a completely different career path, where legal thinking, legal training is actually going to be, and judgment is going to be very relevant, but they're going to think of themselves in 20 years, in my view, they'll think of themselves as business professionals that happen to have a legal background or legal training. So I suppose this part of me that actually says, I agree with you, Basha, you know, innovate or you're in trouble for some segment of law firms. There's this other part of me that says, you know what, there's a whole market segment that's not being addressed by law firms. And there's this last part of me that says, law supply and demand. There are the same number of lawyers are graduating from the top law schools today as graduated 20 years ago. The demand is growing. I'm not an economist either, but what that explains to me is why law firm prices keep on growing, because it's simply supply and demand.
That's a brilliant summary. Let me explore it in a couple of different directions. One question is back to Daryl. So, Liam, as you've explained the different segments of the market, there's clearly demand for and a need for traditional legal services, client-focused, problem-solving, in-the-moment sorts of things, the kinds of stuff that the Orrick Law Firm, as a classic, traditional, highly regarded, elite San Francisco-founded law firm, is calculated to provide, and no doubt still does. At the same time, Orrick, unusually for a private law firm, has built a kind of competition for itself. So to characterize what Daryl leads in Orrick Analytics somewhat unfairly, Orrick is sort of trying to have it both ways. They're trying to have both the classic legal services delivery model, and then there's also this unit within Orrick that you call Orrick Analytics that's trying to behave significantly more like that second category of sort of systems-oriented representation of law in organizations. So the question for Daryl is, how do you sustain both of those models inside a single global operation?
Okay, well, that's a big question. But before I answer it, I want to go back and point out one thing. There is one place where Liam and I compete head-to-head, and that is in the war for talent. Because we both are competing for the same statisticians and technologists and project managers and folks who, whether you're behind the law department firewall, so to speak, running the business, or whether you're working on a specific project, you still need the same top talent. And in that sense, you're right. The talent war is fierce. To answer your question, we don't see having an alternative legal provider type structure like Orrick Analytics inside a more traditional big law firm as schizophrenic or incompatible. Because at the end of the day, they're actually quite helpful to have both. On any matter, there are tasks. So our mantra is the right person for the right task. On any project, whether it's an oral argument for the Supreme Court, or whether it's a big litigation or a big M&A deal, on any of those matters, there is work that can only be done by the most skilled partner, you know, in that very specific subject matter. And then there's work that can be done by a multitude of people. And if you treat any model like a pyramid and you look at the different tasks inside that project, what you want is the work that is best handled by that lead partner should be handled by her. And the work that is best handled by that statistician should be handled by him. And the work with the technologist. But so what you want is a interdisciplinary team that brings all the best folks to the table. So I hear your question. I don't think they're incompatible. In fact, when we bring in partners, and I'm part of the welcome committee. So when a new partner arrives at the firm, we explain how things work at Orrick, the resources you have. And I can't tell you how many times I hear this theme from folks. wow, I don't know how we did this at my old firm. You know, it's so great to have all of these other resources to bring to bear on my problems. We didn't have these at my old firm. And so I don't know how folks don't have a group like Orc Analytics.
I think that's why that it's exactly what the future will look like, and also why the choice for young lawyers is not between old law and new law, but it's all going to be part of the same contiguous ecosystem. And I would say that anyone thinking about a legal career now is going to need to be deeply immersed in the technology in order to be successful.
I appreciate that. So let me focus in the last part of the conversation today. Let me focus on Liam's and Daryl's observation about the war for talent, the fierce competition for talent. So it's tempting in conversations about ALSPs to talk about technology and how technology systems are displacing human talent. But I want to focus directly on the human beings. And here's the observation that prompts the question. In virtually every country that I'm aware of, but I'll focus on the US, the legal education system that evolved over the course of the 20th century and that still dominates in the early 21st century is keyed to producing new lawyers who are going to succeed in that traditional style of client-focused, problem-based, episodic engagement focus. The legal education system is not tuned to produce legal talent that is trained to thrive in this new, more organizationally fluid, multi-level kind of environment that includes law firms and service providers and sort of talent feeders and other disciplines and so forth. So it seems to me that there's, at the moment anyway, sort of a fairly important structural mismatch between how we're training lawyers and what the market and clients say it wants. How are you thinking through that, any version of that problem that comes into your world?
Daryl has nailed the war for talent. I mean, Basha, this is kind of core business for you, I know, but you know, the war for talent. I also think that the war for talent isn't just between, you know, I'll use Orrick and Elevate. It is, you know, we're in a war for talent, which includes the Big Four. I personally love the fact that Daryl, you're building an organization of scale that is interdisciplinary, because what that means is that every year, more and more and more people think differently and have experiences of this sort of multidisciplinary kind of almost holistic approach. And I think, you know, my background is not law, but it's medicine. And when I think about the way that, you know, I was about to say back in the 1970s, you know, people graduated from med school and they were trained to sort of worship at the altar of, you know, I'm going to be a surgeon, at a teaching hospital. But actually today, you think about when any of us really need care, I use that word carefully, you go to the Mayo Clinic and you're actually surrounded by this multidisciplinary, holistic, and you're at the center of it. And all those people, and some of those doctors graduated, you know, 30 years ago, but they now work with all these other medical professionals and technology professionals, and they actually use equipment that was actually built by people who didn't go to medical school. But you know, where I'm going with all of this is I believe that law companies need law firms to be successful in this. We even need the Big Four, which I'm not sure how we managed to get through a call without talking about the fact that the Big Four are really very active in this space, and they're recruiting from law schools. And I think that we spend a lot of time working with law schools on trying to help them with clinics and ways to and internship opportunities and other ways to open the eyes for young law students about the opportunities beyond law firms. But let's be honest, okay, no one has actually made a Netflix blockbuster about working in a law department or working in a law company. You know, they're all about living a life kind of traveling, you know, sort of arguing in front of the Supreme Court, or living a life kind of shifting money around in the Caribbean. So we got to change so not necessarily popular culture, but we've got to just make it something that we all talk about a lot more, including inside schools. People shouldn't look at, and this is one of the challenges, I think, Daryl, that law firms actually do have, which is, you know, looking at the people who actually argue in front of the bench as sort of somehow superior to the people who are the PhD machine learning, I kind of smile when I see that, and that's human, I know, but we gotta, you know, one of the things that I think drives my own personal view to different perspectives around the table is it just takes a village of different capabilities now, and that you know, you could get by before by simply having the lawyer expert. You just can't, that's necessary, but not always sufficient anymore.
I'll answer this question from a pretty different vantage point, though I agree with everything that Liam said, which is what concrete reforms I think we need to make to legal education and bar licensing in the United States in order to welcome this future. And all these views are entirely my own and in no way related to the work that I do at Priori, but with, you know, a quite a bit of observation into what the effects of the system. I think the first thing that we need to do is to have alternatives to a three-year law school education for the myriad kinds of jobs that are going to be needed in the future, that the Mayo Clinic of Law future that Liam is trying to usher in. There are people who need to be trained on the law, but don't necessarily need to go for 3 years and pass a bar exam. And there should be certificates or some other kind of, I leave the licensing regime up to someone else, but I think that those jobs are needed and you don't need to go into $200,000 of debt in order to be able to perform them successfully. And you don't necessarily, and you need to learn a different set of things about software and project management than you do in order to be a traditional practicing lawyer. I also fundamentally think that we need to rethink the, not do away with at all, but rethink state-by-state bar licensing in the United States, which has a tremendous chilling effect on attorneys being able to perform their jobs. Obviously, there are some things where you would need to be licensed in a particular state, but there are a lot of the practice of law and a lot of the future of law in no way hinges on whether you know Louisiana law or California law. And then finally, I think that a lot of, and to maybe carry Liam's medical analogy forward, law students need to have more exposure. And I love clinics. I could write a love letter to Yale Law School. It was three of the best years of my life. But we had a tremendous clinical education, but it did not, and I was in clinics for, you know, every semester I could be. It did not expose me, though, to the range of actual law practice. And you have students going from learning about what is basically on the bar exam, torts and crim law, to showing up at a law firm and not knowing the difference between what being a capital markets lawyer versus an M&A lawyer versus, you know, what being a commercial litigator is. And I don't think that there's a lot of path dependency in law. We see this all the time in the Priori marketplace. If you've been a litigator for 6 years and all of a sudden you want to be a commercial contracts attorney, nobody's interested. And we have people who make decisions without ever having meaningful exposure to the range of different kinds of law practice. And I think a much more integrated and intentional program in the law curriculum is imperative. I could go on about other changes to legal education, but I might have lost the.
Can I add one thing to what Vasha said that I think is really fascinating for me to observe? What I see is this just incredible, sort of almost a gaping hole of opportunity for young, you know, legal minds to be involved in organizations. I'll say in business to sort of simplify it. You know, you think about how you know, the intellect, the judgment, the idea that you're kind of at 18 years old, I know it's not strictly true, but kind of at 18 years old, you're basically making decisions about, I'm going to go into this traditional law path, and I'm oversimplifying, where actually, just think of just think about the benefits to business of being able to actually have young lawyers find a path, find ways into law departments or into corporations more generally. And I just feel that's just such a tremendous, it's a loss for businesses of access to fantastic talent and judgment. And I always joke about the fact that, and ethics, because clearly the rest of us don't have any. But it's also a real kind, it's just a real shame that people with fantastic expertise, experience, judgment, etc., feel that they don't really have a career outside of, they don't, it's hard for them to really get a seat at the table, or they're not, or to move into business roles. And that just, I feel is, you know, I think law schools are kind of, you know, have sort of made the bed with the law firms that they essentially serve as talent generators for. And I think they just miss an opportunity. And it's, you know, I actually say kudos to the Big Four for helping, and kudos to law departments who are really embracing lawyer minds in business. Oh, and law companies.
Okay, so I will carry Liam's medical analogy one more step.
Daryl, I'm gonna give you the last word, because we're gonna wrap up the podcast with your observations here.
I'll be brief. We have a patient on the table, and we do help. You know, we do work with law schools to help change education. But right now, today, we are buried in work. And so, yes, we should work on how to train the lawyers of tomorrow. But we have lawyers today, and the way we focus on helping our folks today be more innovative is by building processes and checklists and workflows and technology integration into the work they do, so that practicing law at ORIC, to do that is to be practicing law in an innovative way, to make it the air we breathe, rather than asking someone to be more innovative as they sit there at their desk. Rather, build the systems and holistic approaches that let them be innovative as they do their work.
Well, that's a great summation. So let's call an end to the podcast today. It's been a quick 30 minutes. Basha, Liam, and Daryl, I want to thank you for your time and for your passion and for your insights, and look forward to having further conversations and connections with you going forward.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Future Law Podcast. For links to the articles mentioned and to contact the hosts, visit futurelawpodcast.com.